Okay.
Well, Mason worked on oxidative enzymes later, but I remember when he worked on the active ingredient of poison ivy, because that was kind of interesting to somebody who'd had a few cases in New Jersey.
Yeah, did he? Well, that's an interesting topic to work on. That would make me a little nervous. Were there other students who went on to chemical or other careers in research? What did most of your...
Yeah, well, there were only 15 of us who were chem majors. A few of them went into industry directly after a bachelor's degree. A few went on to grad school. Another guy who stayed right at MIT for a doctorate, Paul Panagiotakos, ended up with a prophet, Lowell. He died a couple of years ago. Who else was in that class? Leo Epstein, fellow physical chemist who stayed at MIT, took his PhD under Scatcherd, and spent most of his career at General Electric, the Atomic Power Lab, and then out in California, and eventually at Argonne. Leo had a lot to do with the liquid sodium cooling of nuclear reactors. He's retired and living in San Francisco. I see him once every 5 years, roughly, or something like that. One of the very good ones, Percy Ehrlich, I think, had, in a time when there weren't as many fellowships and everything as one would have wished, he went to work after a master's degree at MIT, and he's still in the Boston area.
This, of course, was in the period when the Depression was at its worst.
Yeah.
You started college. How did you support yourself in school, and how did your fellow students...
Well, the answer is a lot of them didn't. The total MIT enrollment when I entered as a freshman in the fall of 31 was close to 3,200. The number 3,193 sticks in my mind for some reason or other. 2 years later, it was down to about 2,200. And they weren't all flunked out. They simply couldn't afford to continue, and the Institute hadn't got scholarship resources for that. It was climbing back up again by 35, but clearly, well, the answer is some of my classmates, too, dropped out because they couldn't afford to stay. 636 of us entered as freshmen, and 400 exactly got bachelor's degrees 4 years later. That's quite some attrition. As for me personally, my father was, a German organic chemist with a doctorate, and I'd say a fair job. He was never he was always essentially a technician. He was sort of the chief chemist of this small firm, which eventually was incorporated into General Printing Inc., which later expanded to become something called Sun Chemical. But it was, anyhow, he scraped together my tuition and room and board. I worked at the dining hall because I felt I should contribute something, and he agreed that I could do that if I wanted. I applied for scholarships and was awarded a token amount, and I probably suppose it was immoral to do so, but it didn't occur to me at the time. So I recall I got $50 scholarship 1 year and $25 another year when the grades were actually better, but that was certainly based... Today, of course, a kid whose family resources are adequate doesn't get any scholarship aid, even if he's all A's. But that time, they settled it by, well, if you applied, we'll give you a token award.
Mm. Was there a stipend connected with being a teaching assistant in that summer fall lab?
Yeah, it was something like $25 a week, as I recall, which was pretty good. In fact, that was sort of the starting salary of most of my classmates when we graduated. Maybe it was, I think possibly I got $150 for the 6 weeks, or it may have been $125. I don't know. I do know that I went out and bought a used Model A for $100. First car I ever owned.
That's interesting. So were there, you mentioned the when you went over to Oxford, you got Pauling and Wilson and read that. Were there other things you recall reading as in your later undergraduate years about, you know, sort of outside reading that had a big influence on you at the time?
Oh, boy. It'd be hard to be too pretentious. I bought a lot of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, but to this day I haven't read most of them.
You're not the first.
Yeah, this was sort of holdover from that sophomore intellectual history course. I ought to learn more about these guys, but Jesus, it was tough going. I also, despite the fact that undergrad physical chemistry was so heavily concentrated on thermodynamics, I felt after almost three terms of mostly thermodynamics that I still didn't really understand it. So another thing I did in Oxford was to buy a Lewis and Randall, which had not been a prescribed text at MIT, and to work through the problems of that on my own. Why the hell I did this, I don't know. I guess maybe I didn't like the experimental work I was assigned in Oxford, and my mentor there was too reserved and perhaps too old to furnish much personal inspiration or contact. He was a very fine chemist named D.L. Chapman, who is remembered to this day by two things. One, he independently did the theory of the electric double layer, now known as a Chapman-Guis double layer. It's essentially one-dimensional Poisson-Boltzmann equation. You can solve it exactly in one dimension, nonlinear and all. And he formulated the adiabatic condition for a shock front, the so-called Chapman-Jouguet condition to describe an explosion. So he's in the books, all right. Mm-hmm. But he was suspicious of Americans, and I don't know that he really wanted me, but he hadn't much choice, as that was the college I was put into. And
Well, that was, maybe we could just backtrack for a minute before we ask you some more about him and what you found at Oxford.
Yeah.
We've talked so far about how you had taken some extra math, you had worked with Slater a bit, taken some courses with him.
Only courses, never really worked with him.
But at least had been introduced to the kind of atomic physics that he and others at MIT were working on. It had plenty of background in physical chemistry.
Yeah, and there was another guy at MIT I should mention already, because he remained an inspiration and later a friend as long as he was alive, and that was Kirkwood. Mm-hmm. Kirkwood had taken his PhD already in 1929 or 30, very young, had a year in Dubai's group at Leipzig as an international research fellow, and then was back. Remember, there weren't many jobs. He was back at MIT. He'd worked already with Slater as a grad student. Mm. He had to do an experimental thesis as a grad student on the dielectric constant of compressed ammonia, but he knocked off a paper with Slater on intermolecular forces, which is still quoted, as a grad student. And he came back to MIT as a research associate in the chem department, and I suppose a miserable salary, and he was around. Mm. And those of us who just about barely knew him, but there he sat calculating, and one knew that he was doing tremendous things, mainly through, well, Scatcherd mentioned him several times in class and things. Yeah. When I came back from Oxford, though, he was gone. By then he was hired away at Cornell as an assistant professor. And
that's very interesting, because of course you began to do work in areas that were congruent with the kind of things that Kirkwood was doing within a couple of years. How is it that you ended up at Oxford? I mean, you just applied for
I applied for a Rhodes Scholarship. Yeah, I was interested in going abroad, and just in a general sort of way, I thought it didn't hurt to apply, and I had no notion that I could possibly receive one. In fact, I was even in love with an American girl and thought, you know, the separation would be fatal to the relationship. Well, ultimately it was, and I'm pleased with that. But don't put that in.
Well, we can always edit that. Well, obviously, if one's faced with the opportunity to take a Rhodes Scholarship, it's pretty clear what to do. But had you thought of going into industry or just going on to grad school in the U.S. at that
time? Oh, yeah, I definitely didn't know what I was going to do. And maybe industry was the right thing to do. And my father, well, I said thanks to my father, I guess I did get a job in the Sun Chemical or General Printing Ink Labs in the summer after graduation, and again in the summer after the 2 years at Oxford. And those two were sufficient to convince me that probably I wouldn't be an adequate industrial chemist. I didn't seem to have that kind of interest. Although, in 1939, when my doctorate was in sight, I did apply at DuPont, went for an interview, and didn't get an offer. They knew. Then they hired me as a consultant many years later, 6 years later, but at the time, I often wondered what that was. It was partly maybe I didn't show enough, you know, savoir faire and interest in the really practical world. And there was one other thing that I often wondered about. On the train going down there, I got into conversation with a man on the seat next to me, and he turned out to be a chemical engineer who had once worked for DuPont and who had been involved in an accident down in Charleston, West Virginia, and felt that he had been ill-treated by the company. And in my completely naive way, I chose to mention this guy to one of the big shots I was being interviewed by, or I thought he was a big shot. He may have been. Not that X thought the company had treated him shabbily, but I'd said, "Oh, I met X on the train. He told me a few things about DuPont." "Oh, is that so?"
Yeah. No,
it was clear.
Who, just out of curiosity, who did interview you for DuPont, do you recall?
I interacted with a man from the personnel department, a guy with a charming fellow called Wade Reinhardt, and I met him in later years. But of the old ammonia department where I was interviewed, one of the people was Larson, who was one of the very well-known people when the ammonia synthesis and the high-pressure work came to the U.S., and who had published some papers in the area, too. Yeah. So he was nice enough, and maybe they just only had about three jobs to give out, and I was not one of the three guys. You know, 39 still wasn't a great deal of hiring going on.
But
in the event, I got an instructorship at MIT and turned in my thesis during that year, 39 to 40. And mm-hmm. So.
Well, let's go back to Oxford briefly. And what was the atmosphere like there compared to MIT?
Entirely different.
Both,
yeah.
Research and also just the social environment.
Well, I had an awful lot of growing up to do, and so about second night in college, when the captain and secretary of the college boat club called on me and asked would I like to learn to row, I said sure. Well, I'd tried rowing a little bit at MIT as a freshman, but I was too worried about my studies then, hadn't done much with it. And I really took to it, and it was number one during my 2 years at Oxford. Science was definitely second. And even though I did work the problems in Lewis and Randall and read some Pauline and Wilson, the river was the thing. Well, I got fairly good at it. I rowed at Henley both years, once in the college crew and once in a university second boat. And I really had a shot at the Oxford crew. I was in the first boat for 3 weeks, and then they saw better. So I have an ISIS tie, if you know what that is, tucked away somewhere. That's the sort of second boat. But
That's interesting. I mean, that certainly didn't come out from the CV.
At our 50th MIT reunion last June, we put together a crew. I never had rowed for MIT, but fortunately, there weren't too many guys around, so I got to row in the boat. We went out for about half an hour. It was fun, sure.
Yeah. That's great. So you're spending time on the river and also doing some work with Chapman. And I wondered if the first paper of yours on the poisoning of palladium.
Yeah, that's
emerged from your years at Oxford.
Exactly that. That was my thesis. Was to some previous guy had found this poisoning thing under certain conditions, and somebody suspected carbon monoxide and surface carbon yields being very stable, and so Chapman put me onto that, and so essentially I had to learn of some glass blowing, but it was a trivial trick to load in known amounts of carbon monoxide and to measure the length of the induction period as a function of the CO pressure, and I got some fairly good preliminary results, and then was succeeded by another student named Max Burrows, who's the co-author of that paper, and he got more data and finished it off. There's a sequel to that. That paper simply gives the data and it gives an empirical equation that fits them. Mm-hmm. One that's too complicated to make any physical sense, but another one that invites theorizing. By this time I was an MIT grad student, and I saw how with the just ordinary Langmuir isotherms, but with the proper ratios of the constants, you could fit all these data. And I wrote a little manuscript and sent it to Chapman. He wrote back and said, that's very interesting, but you can't prove this because it's only one possibility, so I don't approve of this being published. So I put it away. Never did. Tell you one more thing about, or two more things about Chapman, if I may.
Sure.
During the war, he wrote to me. Before U.S. got into the war, but England was already in it, and it was a very cordial letter, completely different from any personal interaction he'd ever had with me, where he was always grumpy and wondering why the hell I hadn't done more instead of being out rowing. It was essentially, I think, motivated by the notion that England was going to need some friends. I don't really know, but maybe it was just that he was unable to project himself face to face, but could do it that way. And I think I answered it, I don't know. I didn't see him again until 1955, which was the next time I was in England. Mm-hmm. I went to see him, very old man now, and I had called up Mrs. Chapman, somewhat younger, and also a chemist who'd worked with him, arranged it all, and I went out there and said, you say you worked for me? I don't remember you. And I said, well, I did, Mr. Chapman, and I'll tell you what I worked on, and you communicated our paper to the Proceedings of the Royal Society, and he sort of told his wife, see if you can find that. And she looked in a cabinet, and sure enough, came out a reprint. He looked at it, and he looked at me, and said, well, I'm dashed. I still don't remember you. And we both felt bad, because I knew that I was such a lousy student that he hadn't remembered me, and he knew that his memory was going. He died the next year, as a matter of fact. After a very unfortunate thing, apparently he fell asleep in the chair in front of the fire, rolled off it, and got sort of singed a bit. Mm. And I think the physical suffering and all.
Could I ask a question about the Oxford system at that time? Because you work in the Jenkins Laboratory at Jesus.
Mm.
When you left in 1937, in fact, the college laboratory system was almost coming to an end.
Yes, it was.
I can't remember now when the physical chemical laboratory was built, but it wasn't long after that.
39. I was gone, but that's when. Yeah, that's
so
right.
What was it like to be in the twilight of the college system? Because at that time, of course, the Balliol Trinity Laboratory was already beginning to pull ahead of the others. Anyway.
Sure. Well, definitely felt something of a second-class citizen. When you get a Rhodes Scholarship, they thrust a piece of paper at you and say, here, this is late December, or middle December, you're chosen, and college admissions have to be done very quickly now. put down in order of preference 10 colleges to which you'd like to be admitted. Well, I'd known that this was going to happen and had done only a little homework, and I knew Hinshelwood was at Trinity. So I put down Trinity 1, Balliol 2. Then where the hell, I didn't care about the Magdalen or Christ Church, which were socially prominent, and Brasenose was reputed to be nothing but jocks, and so Jesus had a lab. So, well, I'll put down Jesus third, and I did, and that's where they put me. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Oxford, I was armed with a letter to Hinshelwood from, no, actually the letter was to Ronnie Bell, who was working there, and that was from Scatcherd, who knew him through his work. I may have had one to Hinshelwood. I had one to the prof, to Charwell from Keyes, Lindemann then, and he received me graciously, but obviously that was only a call to convey Keyes's regards, and it lasted 5 minutes. But I did hope that, even though I was a Jesus man, that they'd take me on and bear the Trinity, but Bell was very kind, but he said, both Professor Hinshelwood and I have already too many students. I think that won't do. In the meantime, they'd been examining, they want to examine my notebooks. Well, kids at American universities didn't keep neat notebooks the way apparently English students of that generation did. So George and Chapman, the two chemistry dons at Jesus, were horrified by these incomplete and childish notes with scribblings in the margin and occasionally a cartoon or irrelevancies of all kinds. And they said, well, you know, we're really not quite sure what to do with you. Why don't you, maybe you should take a BA. And I said, well, I really think I should start, try to do some research. They said, well, go to lectures for a term, we'll think it over. So actually, that was good. I went to Wolfenden's lectures, the man who became my colleague years later. I went to Hinshelwood, I went to H.W. Thompson, who did the spectroscopy, and I went to Schrödinger, who was stopping by there before he got that chair in Dublin, where he spent almost a decade. But Schrödinger, I didn't understand much of what Schrödinger said, but my God, there he was, and I listened to him. So after a term, they gave back all but one. And this is very interesting. I had had a set of notes that Scatcherd had written on colloid and surface chemistry. George never gave those back, and he was the university lecturer on colloid and surface chemistry, and I think he just damn well wanted to use them. But anyhow, they said, all right, you can do research in the Jesus labs, and Chapman said, there's a problem for you, and so I spent the next 5 Oxford terms doing that. But you see, by then it was certainly, I wasn't ready to do a defill there. I really needed more of the American system than that would have made sense to do. And so it was made sense to go home after 2 years. Something I hated to do because I should have been captain of boats at Jesus the next year, and I wanted to row one more year, but it never happened. So I went back to MIT, and this time the Slater course was again a leap forward, a revelation. That was the thing. It was so wonderful. Frank was the lecturer in it that term, and Slater the following one. Ann Stratton, the man who later became president.
Well, there are a couple of questions I wanted to follow up on with Oxford before we get back to MIT. One is, wasn't this the time that Laidlaw was still at Oxford before he had gone?
No, he wasn't there. If he was, I didn't know that. I don't know. I was not grown up enough to interact with the really research people, although I made a couple of friends inadvertently. One was Fred Dayton, F.S. Dayton, who was then doing his undergraduate part two research in Thompson's lab, and there was another American there, interesting one, a man named Milton Meissner, fellow Rhodes Scholar, Lehigh grad, who did take a DPhil in Oxford directly under Thompson. He went into the American chemical industry, had a career in which he was at Olin Matheson, he got more interested in finance than in chemistry for some years, and he ended up as an ally of Robert Vesco. He has spent a little time in prison in Luxembourg. He is now, I think, in Nassau or Costa Rica. No, he's in Costa Rica now. But he would be in trouble if he came back to the States at this stage.
see.
But nice guy, smart guy. But, you know, something happened there. But anyhow, through Meissner, I met Dayton and so on. But I did not know about Laidler. Hinshelwood did the lecturing in kinetics, and that was fun to go to.
Did you have any interaction with Hinshelwood aside from going
no.
to lectures?
There was an Oxford University students or chemistry club called the Alembic Club, of course, and I went to those meetings. The person I did meet that way and who was utterly sociable, friendly, and charming was N.V. Sidgwick. Hmm. But Sidgwick was sort of an Americanophile. He'd been the Baker lecturer at Cornell and a different guy. But Hinch was a rather forbidding person.
Go back to E.J. Bowen. Did you ever come across him?
Who?
Bowen, B-O-W.
Yes, E.J. Bowen. He was one of my two examiners on my BSc. You see, I did a BSc in the event. Bowen was one of them. The other was Hammack. Yeah. No, it wasn't either. It wasn't Hammack at all. It was Lambert, Senior Lambert.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Hammack was organic. It was not James Lambert, but he was called Bertie Lambert. And, yeah, I like Bowen very much. Ted Bowen, he was called, yeah. Yeah. So they were kind to me. They passed me. They must have been.
How many people were working in the lab, was you?
In the Jesus Labs? Six to eight, all doing part twos, or one guy was doing a defill. I saw a couple of them last year, last spring at a Jesus dinner, but I think none of them became really visible. The most promising of them, a really bright lad, was drowned, I think, the summer after he got his degree, just in a summer swimming accident.
How did the labs compare with the MIT labs that you had?
Well, more antediluvian, you could say. Chapman was more interested in the hydrogen and chlorine photochemical reaction than in anything else. That was his really big life's work. Oh, I forgot one. I mean, the really good chemical thing he did was the rotating sector interrupted photopolymerization, the thing that allows you to get lifetimes of radicals, in which Harry Melville first applied to polymerization. So when that came out, I'd known about it because Chapman had done it in the Jesus Labs with a homemade deal in 1922 or 3 to study the lifetime of the iodine atoms and the reaction between iodine and oxalate. But what am I talking about? The labs, yeah, they were... Because he worked with chlorine, he wouldn't have oil pumps. We had mercury diffusion pumps, all right, and these were backed by something called a Sprengel pump, which was in turn backed by an aspirator. And all the glass was soda glass, and one blew it by pumping with 1 foot on a bellows and using a hand torch. So I learned glass blowing, which I never became very neat at, but I could make things that would stick together, and you had to anneal the hell out of soda glass, you know, or it would crack, and learned the hard way. So, very primitive equipment, but the problems, well, the reaction vessel for this stuff was a piece of quartz, and I had to go to the university glass blower several times when that developed a crack or so. But
excuse me.